Today's guest, Doc Hendley, a person who truly is making a difference, one drop of water at a time. You're listening to the Eagles Talent Podcast. Eagles Talent is a speakers bureau featuring people who inspire, educate, and entertain. For more information, visit us online at eaglestalent.com. Hello, and welcome to the Eagles Talent Podcast, and I'm your host, Sheldon Senek. As a bartender, Doc Hendley took a simple concept to heart. Everyone deserves clean water. With his organization, Wine to Water, not only is he inspiring others to take action, but he's taking action himself. On so many levels, Doc talks about teamwork, building relationships, and most importantly, saving lives. I spoke with Doc the morning after he had just taken some much-needed water supplies to Haiti. Doc, from what I understand, you were just in Haiti. Can you tell me what you were doing there?
Yes. We're partnering with a filter factory in Haiti. And actually, what happened is we decided to, right after the earthquake, I was actually in Uganda when it happened. Mm-hmm. Right after the earthquake, I flew directly from Uganda down to Haiti. And the decision that we decided to do as an organization for the type of work we would do, mm-hmm. would be to work with water filters down there. Mm-hmm. And the reason being is because the first thing I noticed down there was that there's a couple different types of water work that was going on. One, there's a whole lot of bottled water coming in. Mm-hmm. And if you think about the average person needs approximately, at a minimum, 3 to 4 liters of drinking water each day. And you think there's about 2.2 million people that were displaced from this. That's a lot of bottled water.
Right.
And they weren't going to be able to cover it all, one. And two, think about the trash amount that's going to come from that and the expense. And the other thing people were doing were tankering water from one clean source and then they were trucking around to different points, but it wasn't effective enough. That tankered water was running out quickly. I noticed that it lasted a couple hours and it would run dry. And then people would go back to drinking water actually off the side of the street from ruptured mains in the city. In different areas. So what we decided to do was to find somebody on the ground locally that had already done some water filters and partner with them. And we found a group in the Dominican Republic that had been building ceramic water filters for quite a few years there. And they basically, I'll explain the filter to you a little bit, and I'll explain the factory that we have going on down there. But mm-hmm. the filter that we use in Haiti, it's like a ceramic water pot, basically. And it costs $30 for a filter. It'll take care of a family of 5 up to 10 people in that family for over 5 years. And basically, it's like a flower pot that when you fire it, like you fire any type of ceramic,
uh-huh.
There's the fine sawdust that's mixed in, and that sawdust burns up and it leaves these little porous holes, and water trickles through, and there's fine-grained silver also mixed in with that. And so from this system that we have going on for $30, these families are getting 99.9% power clean water, which is like hospital grade clean water,
uh-huh.
for a $30 filter for a family. So when I learned about these people on the ground in the DR, I was immediately sold on the filter. We partnered with them and began trucking these filters into Haiti, right?
Mm-hmm.
We bought a truck. We have bringing these guys in, and then I was talking with the partners there in the DR, and they're like, it may be best if we put a factory on the ground in Haiti and have the Haitians building their own filters. I'm like, that's exactly what we like to do. Everywhere in the world where we're working, whether it's Cambodia, Uganda, Peru, we always use local organizations to do the work and local people groups. So I'm like, that's perfect. So they agreed to help us with that. They agreed to help us set up a factory and then have it be run by Haitians. So what I was down there doing is we just put on the finishing touches of our filter factory based in Haiti. It's in an area called Jacmel. We had a lot of issues with the government of Haiti allowing us to bring in the rest of the equipment needed to finish the factory.
I saw that on your Twitter post. You said it said you ran into some roadblocks. And is that common down there?
It hasn't been up until April 14th. The government of Haiti basically took over all the border stuff from the different NGOs, non-government organizations, the different military groups, the U.S. military. It was all handed back over to Haitians, and they don't have a system in place at all. They kept telling me I needed a stamp. I got a certain stamp, and they said, no, you don't have the right stamp. And then basically at the end of it, there was one big main official that said, if you give me $2,000, I'll let you go through. And I was like, no, I don't think so. I tried all kind of different other methods. I don't mind. In my mind, this is a pretty simple rule that I live by right now, and that's that water is a basic human, not just need, but a human right. Mm-hmm. And because I feel like it's a human right, there's no law in any country in anywhere in this world that can keep me from giving somebody that needs clean water, clean water. Right. And so I don't mind if I need to bend the rules a little bit to get across the border or whatever. And so they wouldn't let me cross the border. I even tried just in the morning getting up really early, right when they let down the chain that covered the border, and just driving across. And it kind of backfired. I guess I was inspired by the A-team. They just drive across, you know, pull it out. But a one-man A-team doesn't do very well.
You need BA.
So anyway, that didn't work out so hot. And so what ended up happening, I found a port city in the south of the Dominican Republic where there's a lot of nice big old fishing boats. And we piled a fishing boat full of all our gear and hopped on a boat. It took us 8 hours through the night to get to where our factory is, unloaded everything at sunrise at 5:30 in the morning, and finished the factory. And it was a little bit different than I'd planned. I planned on getting there from a nice air-conditioned truck, but an eight-hour boat ride will get the job done. So sorry, that was a long explanation of what I was doing.
That's okay. For listeners who aren't as familiar with the organization you began, Wine to Water, what is Wine to Water and how did it start?
Wine to Water, we are a nonprofit. We are an organization that is it's very simple. We're focused on providing clean water to people in need around the world. I started this organization as a bartender, and that kind of leads into the name Wine to Water. Right. Basically, I've never done any event before. I've never been a part of any organizations before. I've never done anything like that. But when I learned in 2003, when I learned about the water crisis, I was so upset. I was so angry. I was so just filled with any emotion you can think of when I found out that water kills more children than anything else in the world. Mm-hmm. And the three below it, HIV/AIDS is number two, malaria is number three, and tuberculosis is number four. Water kills more than all three of those combined, yet receives less than 20% of the funding, and those three receive over 80% of the funding. So I was really upset when I found that out. I was really upset that nobody else knew about this. And so I decided, you know what? I may only be a bartender, but I'm going to do what I can to do something about this problem. So the way that it ended up coming about, all I knew how to do was bartend, and I knew people would come for a good time if there was some good music and maybe some good drinks and good food. So I held an event early 2004. It was February 2004 that basically got a wine distributor to give free wine. I got Anheuser-Busch to give free beer. I played live music at the event, and then we had a DJ later on. So everybody got to come for free and hang out and have a good time. And then I got a platform with a few hundred people. Said, look, glad you're here at a Wine to Water event. Let me tell you why you're really here. You're having a good time. It hasn't cost you a dime. I want to tell you about a problem in the world that I guarantee that you don't know about. And I'm going to give you a chance to do something about it if you want to. If not, great. We're glad you're here. At least you know now. And it was that one event just was like a spark that lit a fire. And there was another restaurant over there that wanted to do one of these Wine to Water events at his place. And I never even intended for this to become like an organization. This was my way as a bartender just to give back, just to do these events.
Right.
And it just took off after that without me even really knowing that it was going to happen. So it's kind of a crazy story.
You know, what's so intriguing to me is that, you know, some people will come into a place like Dafar, Uganda, Haiti with all good intentions, but it's really so short term. And you really seem to take a different approach. Like in Darfur, you took the time to live there. How is doing this change your views of these various countries and the cultures?
Oh, it's changed everything for me. That's a good example you use for the first one. Like, take Darfur. I lived in Darfur for a year. And from 6 months after my first event, I was in Darfur living there all the way through the other half of 2005. Excuse me. And in Darfur, first of all, it's 95% Muslim. So you think about this. I've never been to a developing country, much less an African country, much less a Muslim country. I didn't even know any Muslims.
Right.
So I didn't know what to think of Africans. I didn't know. I was a little worried going in. I've never been living in a tribal type community. On top of that, one that's 95% Muslim. And think about it, not long after 9/11 in 2001. And, so I had always preconceived ideas. But when you live in an area, more than just a couple-week trip, I fell in love with the Darfur people. I fell in love. I tell you, I have the utmost amount of respect for my Muslim friends that I met there and that I work with. I fell in love with the culture, everything. But it takes, I think, sometimes living in an area, staying at somebody's house, playing with their kids, seeing that they're normal, everyday human beings just like us. It takes doing that to really be able to empathize the people that you're working with and to see that they're just human beings, basically.
Right.
So, yeah, I think it's important really to take the time out to get to know the people you're working with and to realize their humanity and that no matter what religion they are or where they're from, they're people. They're just like you and I.
You know, in addition, you've really focused on using materials and people within the country rather than outsourcing materials. What impact has that made on the people of the countries you're helping?
Well, it's huge. It's very empowering. If you think about this, think about if there's a huge disaster in the States, all right? Let's take a Katrina or a Nashville flood disaster or something big, and maybe even compound a little more and have even a lot more death and destruction, okay? And we're sitting in a place where we're reliant on the outside world for help. Like, the U.S. is in a bad spot, and the outside world is helping us. As you, as a either a husband or a father or a mother or whatever, would you rather have another country come and spoon feed you and give you food and give you this, and that, and the other, and come in and out of your life once every few weeks and drop off food and just take care of you that way? Or would you rather somebody come and say, here's some tools to start, doing this, so that when I leave, you can take care of your own family. You can take care of your own needs. When you give somebody the ability to take care of themselves, it's empowering. It creates ownership over whatever the project is that you're doing. And what also I see it help with for us is I'm not going to have the liberty to live in every one of the areas where we are because I didn't want to grow as an organization. So I can't just be at all places at all times.
Right.
And I don't want to just grow and just have for every place we have five or six Americans working it. So if I'm in 10 countries now, I need 50 Americans to run it. The whole idea was that, that these people are capable no matter what country, no matter what religion, no matter what tribe, no matter what, they're capable if you just give them the tools and the training necessary. And then that alleviates my problem of I don't want to grow into this big organization with 100 personnel traveling all over the world with airline tickets. So there's a lot of things that it solves by using local people. It's much better equation all around in my mind, but it's not used nearly enough with organizations for some reason.
You know, there are a few goals I've heard you state with your Wine to Water organization. One is do more with less. The second is build relationships. And third, saving lives. Is it accurate to say that the more you do and can do in any of these categories, it's probably not only infectious, but it could be even addicting?
Yes, because What you see is, first off, when you provide someone with the most basic need of clean water, and you see that you very well have saved this individual's children, because in a lot of these areas where we work, it's very likely that if an individual has like four or five kids in their family, more than likely one of them at least is going to die because of water.
Right.
It's just kind of a given. And if you can look at a family or a few families, let me start out and say, I've just saved their child. I have two kids now, and that's huge when I think about it now, knowing that I have two kids and that if somebody else were to do that for me. So it's very addicting and empowering. But to know that you can do that for a fraction of the cost of what maybe some of the big, multi-million dollar organizations are doing it with, by just simply letting the people kind of take control of their own needs, their own fixes, by just empowering them. I'm telling you, it's like this really cool, perfect storm that just happens, and it brews, and it grows, and you get excited, and it's very, yes, I would definitely say it's very addictive and exciting all at the same time.
When I listen to you speak about your projects and your organization, I hear such an intimate passion. Did you ever have those discussions with your family, you know, when you were younger about, you know, what is it that you want to do with your life? And now, how surprising was this idea to them of what the organization has become?
That's a great question. I feel like before I had water to direct my passion towards, I had a lot of energy, a lot of something built up within me. But to be really brutally honest with you, I directed it towards all the wrong things, I feel like.
Right.
For quite a while growing up through high school, and then on, you know, 10 years after high school or whatever, I directed that energy into a lot of the wrong places. I didn't know where it was coming from. I didn't know what I had, why I had all this fuel and passion inside me. So I made a lot of mistakes. But right when I found water, this issue, and I began directing that energy and that passion that was just naturally there, that I feel like I have it within me, it all made sense. Everything made sense. It fell into place. So I'd love to say, yeah, I always had a passion to save the world as a child, but it's not the truth. I did a lot of the wrong things to get to where I've, you know, the right things started coming along. So.
You know, many people might think of your clean water projects only as only focusing on the point of the water source. And it really goes beyond that to the point of use. Can you talk about that?
That's it. Yes, that's very important. A lot of people think that this water work is drilling wells. When you talk about water work, like, they'll probably be surprised at the first part of this podcast they hear about filters.
Right.
But because people think of NGOs that do water work as, oh, they're a well drilling organization. And we do drill wells. But it's, studies have shown that if you drill a well in a village, and even if they're only walking, let's say, 10 minutes to that well and back to their house, which is in a long walk in the developing world. A lot of the places are 2 to 4 hours.
Uh-huh.
So once you get even just a few minutes walk back and forth, and that container that they have that's supposed to have clean water, and it gets back to the house and actually gets their children's lips to where they're drinking it, that water is dirty. It goes back to being filthy. Even if the water is clean coming out of that well, there's a number of different reasons for that, whether it's different insects and flies in the air, whether the container itself was unclean, whether, you know, whether the children may have put their hands in the bucket, you know, who knows? There's, for whatever reason, though, hands down, throughout anywhere in the world, it's shown that the water gets dirty from the well to the house. So what's important is to have, like we have in the States, we turn on a tap, you put water in a glass, you drink it immediately. That water is clean, it comes out, and it goes right to your mouth. And they need to have that same capability to where the time that it's sitting in the open where things could happen to it is a minimal. And when you have a filter, which is called point of use, it's right where you use it, filtration, point of use filtration. Basically, it's got a little nozzle on the bottom where the clean water is, and that clean water is sealed off from the rest of the world. And that nozzle goes right to that child's glass, goes right to their mouth, and it never has a chance to get dirty. So it's really important. We do drill wells, and it's great to do that, because that way kids can go to school. They're not walking 4 hours to get water anymore. But you have to tag it along with that point-of-use technology as well. So they need to go hand-in-hand.
Does clean water affect economic growth, you think?
It is the most important thing for economic growth. Now, I love the fact that in the world right now, especially throughout the aid world, the humanitarian world, sustainable development programs and microfinance programs and all these things are becoming really big, which are great. I think that's awesome. However, none of them will succeed. No education program, no economic program for an area. They will never succeed if they don't first lay that foundation of providing that community clean water. That will never happen. And here's an example. Let's say you want to make a community better, and so you're going to bring them jobs and build a factory in a small community in South America. Okay? Your workers in that factory are always going to be late, or they're not going to show up, or whatever, because either they're sick, or the kids are constantly sick. You don't get any, or they're actually dying, or the children are dying, or whatever. In a developing situation, if you try to create like a Western-style world or job structure, economic structure, without giving them clean water first, it'll all come crashing down like a building without a foundation.
Right.
However, if you just take this is what's crazy. Those fixes are difficult. To change the economic structure of a community is a pretty difficult thing. But to give that community clean water is so easy, yet we overlook it. If you just drill a well there, put some filters out in the community, and then do your factory, you got healthy babies, healthy people, happy people coming into work, and then you can start working on that. So it's not important. It is vital. It is the most important thing for beginning any type of economic development. They have to have at least clean water first.
Wars are fought so much over religion, government, oil. Should there be a concern about a war over water?
Yes. In my opinion, and I hope I'm wrong. Right. I do truly hope I'm wrong. But in my opinion, the next major war in this world, and major, I think, being way bigger than anything that's happening in the Middle East right now, will be over water. That's something that I think a lot of higher-up UN officials are stating now more and more, and are seeing that in their travels and knowing, seeing the tensions that are happening because of water. Yes, hands down, I agree that with them saying that the next major world war probably will be fought over water, which is a scary thing. Well, I think it could maybe not happen if we start addressing it now. The problem is nobody even knows it's that big of an issue in the Western world, which is why I guess I'm here to try to scream and shout and let people know that this is going on.
So you were just in Haiti. Are you heading back there, or what countries are in your scope right now?
Well, I'm talking from the Dominican Republic right now. I just came over. I'm with my partners right now that we're building the factory with in Haiti. And I'll be going back to the States, and I have a few wine to water events going on. I think we have two or three different ones in Miami later this month. So I got a lot of events going on. But then the next international trip will probably be another one back to Haiti, because it is close and pretty easy to get to. So I'll come back here in a month or two to check up on everything and my guys down here. And then not long after that, probably September, I'm over to Cambodia. And like I said, I just had a new baby. And what I'm hoping is that on that trip, I can spend like 3 or 4 weeks in Cambodia and bring my family. Because Cambodia is one of those areas where, yes, it's developing, but it's not quite a Darfur or even a Haiti. It's pretty secure, and I would feel comfortable having my family. So I'm hoping I can do a pretty long trip to Cambodia in September and have my family there. And in Cambodia, we drill 16 wells a month, every month in Cambodia. And for every well, we put in 10 filters in that village. And then we also help them build latrines and teach them about hygiene and sanitation and stuff like that as well. So we got a great program in Cambodia.
You know, you bring up the issue of family and your children. And issues like water contamination are so important, not only to us, but our children. What is it that you want adults to walk away with and children to walk away with?
If they're listening to this podcast, to me, the biggest thing is just put yourself, it's very difficult to empathize with somebody that doesn't have clean water, because for us, it's just so easy. And I always say this, that it doesn't matter how poor or how bad off you are in the States. You could be a bum on the street that's lost your family, your job, everything, but you'll still always be able to walk into a public restroom or somewhere and get a clean cup of water that's not going to kill you. So what I would hope that people could do if they're listening to this is just try for a minute to empathize what it would be like if your children or you or all of you had to walk every single morning and every single night, hours upon hours, to gather your water that you're going to drink and use for the day. And not only that, but to have that water very much potentially be making your children sick and potentially be killing them at the same time. Imagine what that would do to your spirit and how it would shoot you down, and you can't even get ahead in life if you can't even provide your children a cup of clean water that's not going to kill them. How demoralizing would that be? And to me, that's where this passion comes from, I feel like.
Right.
That when I start to think about it in those terms, now that I do have two kids, my passion has grown like tenfold. So if you're listening to this and you're either a child or you're an adult, just think about the children that do that. And on average in East Africa, it's a 4-hour walk every single day, and that water is definitely making them all sick at some point in time. At some point in time during their month or whatever, they're sick by it, and very potentially is killing that child as well.
You know, Doc, what you're doing is really great in so many levels. Just the bigger picture of it with the water contamination, working with people, creating a team atmosphere. It's really great what you're doing over there. So, Doc, it has been just a great pleasure having you on this podcast, and thank you so much.
No, it's been my pleasure and my honor to be talking with you. And this kind of stuff is huge because there's so many people that if they do that don't know, and if they just did know how bad this is and the need, there's people out there like me that say, well, I may be just a bartender, I may just be a businessman or whatever, but I'm going to do something about this. I'm not going to allow this to happen anymore. So no, this is a huge honor for me as well, man.
If you're interested in bringing Doc Henley into your next event, then visit us online at eaglestalent.com. Thank you so much for joining the Eagles Talent Podcast. I've been your host, Sheldon Senek.